Hello, 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 and welcome out there in podcast land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys, a podcast where two old friends get together and discuss horror, science fiction, movies, the influences they've had on us, and how they have influenced other genre pieces. My name is David. I'm here with my good friend Tim. Hey, Tim.
Hey, David. How is it going out there?
It is going. We just both want to say happy holidays to everybody. We want to say welcome back if you are returning to listen to us. If you are a new listener or watcher on our YouTube channel, thank you for tuning in to us. And we hope you enjoy the show and you'll tell all your friends and come back and do all that fun stuff.
Yeah. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving. If you do... listen to us on the podcast. We do have a YouTube channel, so you could go over there and actually see us if that's your preference, I guess. And if you're on the YouTube channel, hey, the podcasts are great. You can take them with you. You don't have to hold your phone out. You can just listen to them in the car or while you're working or, you know, whatever.
Technology.
That sort of thing. Technology. It's amazing. And we're just expanding. This is our third season, and we're, you know, in your face kind of thing, you know.
So,
what have you been up to? What have you been doing since last we conversed?
Oh, well, you know me. I'm always diving into some form of a horror movie or another. And I've been on a bit of a Boris Karloff kick, and it has segued into something else. I told you back when we were covering Val Lewton that I watched The Body Snatcher, which had Boris Karloff in it. I recently tuned into another Todd Browning film called The Old Dark House, which is kind of a comedy horror, and it features a lot of folks besides Karloff. It features, I can't think of her name. Who's the lady that was in Titanic? The old
in the
lady.
Movie?
Yeah. She was like a silent film actress that went all the way to James Cameron's Titanic, and then I think she died.
What was her name? I can't.
Anyway,
yeah, they threw her overboard. I can't remember. No, I can't remember her name.
Yeah,
sorry.
She's in it. Melvin Douglas is in it. Charles Lawton is in it. A lot of good folks. Sorry that I can't remember your name, lady. Anyway, Karloff.
But you were that special to me.
Karloff played another mute, disfigured character similar to the Frankenstein monster, a little scarier, had a big like scar down the middle of his face, and I just thought it would be interesting to see. And you know what, I said Todd Browning and I was mistaken. That it was James Whale, and the reason I brought it up is we know, both of us know from the podcast we did a couple seasons back, that James Whale and Karloff did not get along on the Frankenstein set. So I was curious to see how this movie turned out. And then I was flipping through Amazon Prime, and I saw Die Monster Die, which is a 60s AIP movie with Karloff that I had never seen. So
okay.
I thought, let's watch that. That sounds cool. I start watching it, and lo and behold, it is another adaptation of The Color Out of Space.
Oh.
So I had told you a few weeks back about watching The Color Out of Space with
Nicolas Cage.
Mm-hmm. So I ended up watching this one, which was really bizarre and very AIP, you know what I mean, as far as American International Pictures. It looks like a Poe set or a Poe story,
right,
because they did so many of them. And anyway, so I started thinking, how many adaptations have there been of The Color Out of Space? It seems like that may be Lovecraft's most adapted story. So I did a little research, and I stumbled across another adaptation that I watched that was filmed in Germany. It's called, like, Die Karbe, I think. But if you go onto Amazon, it is free with Prime, and they just call it The Color Out of Space, and it's a black and white tree icon is the picture for it. And it is a black and white film. It is very low budget, and I wanted to see it because somebody said that it was not only the best adaptation of the story, but the best adaptation of any Lovecraft ever. And I was like, well, that's pretty bold. And
okay.
I can't disagree with them. It had Yeah, it's pretty good as far as creating that sense of ominous dread and the cosmic horror without, you know, showing a lot, but just creating that really menacing, I don't know, fear.
And it's called Dicarbe with a K.
Yes, I'm pretty sure. But anyway, you don't. You can just look it up as The Color Out of Space. It's not.
Okay.
I mean, if you look it up like that on IMDb, it'll come up as The Color Out of Space, even if you type in those German words. So.
Okay.
So anyway.
Interesting.
And it was 2005 is the year. If you're interested in checking it out, I highly recommend it.
Now, have you seen the? What is it? Is it an AMC series or some kind of series on that's Lovecraft?
No, it's HBO.
HBO.
Yeah.
HBO Max or something.
I haven't. Now, I have read the book that series is based on, and it's very good. So I'm curious to see the HBO series, but I have not seen it yet.
Interesting. Yeah. You just had a Lovecraftian, you know, journey
from Karloff to Lovecraft. It was weird.
Yeah.
It was a weird segue.
That's cool.
But, yeah.
That's cool. I guess the only thing I've really done genre related to my genre is I'm really the trailer has dropped for Villanueva, or you know you pronounce it better than I.
Villanueva.
Yes.
Villanueva.
He's like he's great. Yes, you know him personally. You know him personally. Anyway, he has done his version of Dune.
Oh, that's and right.
So the trailer is out and looks phenomenal.
Okay.
And the trailer is worth it for everybody just because it has an all original version of a Pink Floyd song as their soundtrack. And it is awesome. It is really, really good.
What do you mean?
There's a Pink Floyd song in it that has, I don't think it's Welcome to the Machine. Trying to remember which one it is, but it's the underlying soundtrack for the entire trailer.
Interesting.
And it's a really good version. It's very haunting and slow and sung by vocals, and it's really nice. It's awesome.
Is it the original recording or someone else doing it?
No, it's someone else. It's okay. A new version. It's Hans Zimmer, who normally does all the synth stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He did this one as a special tribute. And it's really good because Aronofsky, do you remember, not Aronofsky, the other one, when we were doing Alien, remember that Dan O'Bannon came back from Spain where he was working with, I want to say Aronofsky, maybe it is. Anyway, they were doing this big think tank because they were doing the version of Dune that he wanted to do. This is before David Lynch. And Lynch took some of his, but H.R. Giger and Dan O'Bannon both worked on that version.
A lot
of
people were involved with that before Lynch.
Yeah,
got it,
he had created this huge think tank of all these great artists all over the world. Blah 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 blah. But then they lost the funding and he couldn't do it. Well, he had approached both Waters and Gilmore at the time to do the entire soundtrack.
That's awesome.
So Villanueva evidently knew the whole history, da da da, and part of his homage to that version and everything is using some Pink Floyd music in the soundtrack. But it's really good. It's really cool. I highly recommend it.
And you've read that book, right?
Uh-huh.
Okay, yeah. I've never read it, but I know it's like a sci-fi landmark.
It's a tome.
Yeah.
And, you know, there would not be a, you know, talk about, you know, keys, there would never have been a Star Wars without Dune.
Oh.
If you read Dune, it's like, okay, so a young kid, desert planet, doesn't know his own destiny.
Sand
has
people.
To be, you know, goes against these evil, the evil empire that is trying to take over the galaxy. And I was going, okay, so thanks, George. You know, yeah. Now, I have not read the other 8 or 6 right. or however many they continued all of that. But the first one I thought was really good.
Yeah.
Dune was great.
Yeah, that's usually my rule. I always try to read the first one. And then if it really knocks me out, I'll go on, like with Interview with a Vampire. But a lot of books, I only read the first one.
Yeah. But like they show, you know, part of the trailer, they show the whole scene, which is really great, when the Bene Gesserit arrives and she has the box and she's doing the test of Paul and he has to put his hand in the box. And she goes, some people go mad. Some people do this. You know, she's giving all this thing. And he goes, well, what's in the box? And it just cuts to that shot of her. And it's really, you know, intense and holds. And she just goes, pain. And then it cuts. And I went, oh, yeah, Tim will like it now.
Okay. It sounds like Barker almost, like the Cenobites.
Yeah. I think the Cenobites are kind of, you know, the Bene Gesserit or that and the, you know, the stargazers, the actual guys that humans that are mutated into the travelers, which is the only way they can navigate in space. I read an article. It kind of inspired me to look into my Dune history, and I read a great essay that I thought was phenomenal that said that the whole thing about Herbert's novel that sets it apart from almost all other science fiction novels or anything else is there are no aliens in it. Even though it's the Harkonnens, the Atreides, I mean, all these families. You know, it's a big political thriller, right? So it's very Game of Thrones before Game of Thrones. That's the way Dune is. It's all these ruling families and how they rule the galaxy. You know, and some of them are in charge of space travel. Some of them are in charge of all the industrial. Some of them are in charge of the agrarian. But their families rule, almost like a barony, almost like a, you know, an English sort of a caste system. But, and so because they're on all these alien worlds, these alien planets, and there's this, you know, science fiction technology, you think, oh, God, that's an alien. No, they're not aliens. They're all humans who have expanded out into the galaxy, and then this is where they are, you know, 10,000 years from now or 5,000
right.
years from now.
Well, it's kind of like the world.
Yeah, yeah, but I mean, what's interesting
came from nomadic tribes that just went from continent to continent when they were connected or whatever. If you believe in science,
right.
That is what happened.
If you believe in science, wear your masks.
Yeah,
but so it was very interesting because this whole essay was about, you know, the thing about Dune that makes it so interesting is it's all about humans.
Okay,
it's not
cool.
About aliens.
Well, and we've talked about, oh my God, here we are beating that door down again. What makes a good horror or science fiction story? It's the characters, not necessarily the threat or the monster. So,
please.
Right.
Speaking of characters. Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
Are we going to talk some today?
Devil babies on the way.
Devil babies.
We're going to dive into a little bit of Satanism again this happy holiday season.
This happy holiday season. See the fire? Look.
Yes, I guess, should I go ahead and lead into our topic?
Yes, please.
All right, we are going to be talking today about 1968's Rosemary's Baby, which is directed, I don't know if you're going to sneeze or if you're just hiding because you're scared.
No, both. And I was humming the song.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Roman Polanski is a controversial director. We'll get into that a bit, I'm sure. But this is also an iconic film. Lives in a lot of people's memories, especially people from that generation, seeing something like that on the screen for the first time. The story is about Rosemary and Guy Woodhouse, who are a young married couple that move into a somewhat iconic apartment building in New York City. Guy is a struggling actor. All of a sudden, Guy's career starts taking off, but odd things start happening with Rosemary. And she is pregnant. She gets pregnant, and she begins to start thinking that what she may have conceived is not human, and could in fact be the child of Satan, spawn of Satan. What is your first impression of this movie, David? What do you remember? I mean, I guess, yeah. What would be your first impression when you saw it first, or your first memory?
I think my first memory of this was the poster, which may have even been the book cover as well, but the green mm-hmm. with the silhouette of the baby carriage, and thinking, what could that be about, sort of thing. I seem to remember seeing it in a theater, but it had to have been a re-release, of course, but I don't know if that's just my imagination or not, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I remember back then watching it thinking, you know, this really isn't that scary. I don't know why this has lasted. And then rewatching it for this, for the podcast, I was going, okay, it's just a well-crafted movie. Even if it isn't that scary, mm-hmm. I'm not even sure if it would have been scary in the 60s. It may have been, I guess, maybe. But it was very, the imagery is very iconic in it, I think. I think a lot of credit goes to, well, Mia Farrow especially, mm-hmm. To Levin's screenplay, and then to Polanski's direction. I say all the time that one of the things I love about Kubrick is no matter what film he does, he puts images in front of your eyes that you can't forget.
Right.
Whether it's, you know, Full Metal Jacket and its warfare, or The Shining, or even
Clockwork Orange.
Clockwork Orange, Barry Lyndon. Mm-hmm. This was before 2001, and yet there are iconic images in this, not just the last scene, which everybody remembers, but just some iconic shots in it, from the way the dream rape thing is done to certain shots with Cassavetes and Mia Farrow. And it's just, he's very well structured, I thought. Mm-hmm. I do think it bogs down a little bit in the beginning. It takes forever to me to kind of get started, I think. But once it goes into what I call the Ira Levin, once somebody, you know, Ira Levin was big on, let's give the mystery and the whole audience knows it, but the cast doesn't. So now we're rooting for them to figure it out. We've already figured it out. Why can't you see this? Very Hitchcock kind of feel. You know?
Actually, Roman wrote the screenplay. Ira wrote the book.
Right.
So Roman changed a few things. Like the neighbors. What's their name?
Castavets.
One of them's name's Roman, which yeah. I don't think is a coincidence. But I mean, she could have been. I mean, he could have been Roman in the book. I don't know. I haven't read the book. But then again,
I mean, I also have in my notes that I remembered this movie again in black and white.
Oh, that's funny.
So maybe the first time I saw it wasn't in a theater. Maybe it was like with a black and white television
set,
you know, or
yeah.
something. And maybe I saw an edited version.
That's where I was leading. My mother would never have let me see this movie or The Exorcist. And because, I mean, horror movies are one thing, but devil movies were a whole other ballgame. And I saw this and I saw The Exorcist when they were edited for television and aired as like a Monday night movie or whatever.
Okay. Probably ABC.
Yeah.
I was going to say
that. So, but I mean, I don't remember that much being cut. I'm sure some of the rape scene was cut because it's mostly implied anyway. There's no real nudity that I remember.
Yeah, she has one nude shot.
Yeah, there's one scene where they mess around on the apartment floor before they have furniture too, I think, where they get naked, don't they?
Yeah.
Or am I thinking of a different movie? Okay.
No, that's it.
Okay. But anyway, that was my first impression, is finally getting to see it, you know, knowing I wanted to see it and finally getting to see the edited version, same as Exorcist.
Right.
Do you remember the tagline?
The tagline? No.
Pray for Rosemary's Baby.
Aw, please do, because...
Because it's the devil.
It's the devil, baby.
There is, you know, it's funny that you said that you thought this movie, you associate this movie with being black and white. There's another thing out there where people believe that Alfred Hitchcock did this movie. I thought that was funny.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Like a Mandela mm-hmm. effect one?
And apparently he was really? Offered the chance, but or that he was also offered the chance, but that it's all been proved as false, that he was never even approached to do this movie. Hmm. Which is kind of a shame, because, you know, what'd he go do next? Family Plot, which was not that great.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, this, as far as Polanski, is considered loosely part of a trilogy of what they call urban horror movies, which also would include Repulsion and The
Repulsion.
Tenant, which I have not seen. And I have not seen Repulsion.
I haven't either.
In a long time. That should be on
well,
the
I
list,
remember.
Though.
I remember, and I think Joe mentioned this to me once too, that one of the things that always made Polanski work was he's really good, and even did it later on in the action movie, I think, with Harrison Ford. Cannot remember it right now. But
Something in Paris.
Yeah, it was something,
it was,
you know, because they filmed
it
where he
France.
Was.
I know what
Europe.
You're talking about.
But
well, that
but,
makes sense because he lives in Paris.
He's really good at making his characters isolated and making them feel alone in an urban setting. Mm-hmm. And I think he definitely does it in Repulsion, but I mean, I think this is his best version of it. We feel so sorry and empathetic to Rosemary because she really, I mean, she's doomed from the very beginning. She doesn't have, you know, she just is slowly cut off and cut off and cut off from everything around her.
Right. Yeah, I've read where Mia Farrow is not a fan because she feels like Rosemary was walked all over. And she feels like, as a woman, that was a disservice she played in that by doing this film. However, this film is what put her on the map. I mean, she was only known for Peyton Place, a soap opera at the time.
Right.
And being married to Frank Sinatra. So this was basically the movie that put her and Roman Polanski, I think, on the map.
Oh, yeah. I would sure. definitely say so. It's her performance. She's really, really good in this.
I think
hard to be
good in it, though.
Well, I know you'll get into casting, but mm-hmm. to me, I think Cassavetes is a bit miscast. Mm-hmm. In that, I think he's great, and I've always liked him and everything he's done. I think he's a very strong actor. However, I don't ever trust him in this movie.
No.
I always think Guy's a bad guy.
Right.
And so there's no twist at the end when Guy turns out to be a bad guy.
Totally agree. When we get into casting, there's other issues with that and other actors, too. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah, that's funny. But I love Ruth Gordon in it, and we'll get to her as well. And she won an Oscar. I mean, she's fabulous as Minnie Castevet. I mean, she is such the non-stereotypical villain. Such a word, I don't know if I'm... You know what I'm saying. You would never cast that type
well, that's
of mannerism
kind of,
as a villain.
That was going to be my question to you, is from a thematic. So why is this movie so highly regarded in the horror world? Because it's really not that scary. It broadcasts its entire story from the poster, you know, kind of thing. So we know the story, and there's really not any jump scares or...
Well, honestly,
even
you don't know it from the poster. You just know that it's about Rosemary's baby. You don't know that it's the devil. If I had to, and this is going to show my horror nerdiness... If I had to credit the success of this movie, it would be almost the... Remember how we used to talk about the Robert Block endings? How they would always have a twist, you know, a surprise mm-hmm. twist. That's, I think this was a surprise twist to American audiences at the time. They had never seen anything like this. They were waiting for a happy ending, and all of a sudden... Guess what? this isn't a happy ending at all.
So then I would have to ask, is the twist the fact that what we all thought was real, meaning she was raped by the devil and this is his baby, is true? Or the fact that at the very, 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 very end, she accepts it? Is that the twist? What do you mean by the twist?
I think the twist is that it's a downbeat ending. It's not a happy ending. America, I agree with that. In 1968 were not used to seeing movies that didn't end happily. So it ends dark.
Right.
As far as that ending was, they filmed, I think I'll have to get into my notes. They filmed multiple endings for this, but I think that was Polanski's choice. The book, I think Levin has her go on to raise the baby and take it to the Vatican and let them deal with it or something. I can't remember what it was. Anyway.
Okay.
Levin he was a popular novelist, but he was also known as a conspiratorial novelist. Like, all of his books dealt with conspiracies. Rosemary's Baby dealt with, you know, a woman having the spawn of Satan. Stepford Wives was about a town where all the women were robots. And then he did The Boys from Brazil, which was a conspiracy that the Nazis were, you know, he was known for that kind of thing. And may have been a typecast as a result, now that I think about it. But back to your original question, what I meant by twist is that I think people expected it to end happily, either her to cure the baby or the baby to not be the devil, or it was all in her imagination, or you know what I'm saying? And it didn't. It ended up.
Or even grab the baby and jump out the window, you know, something.
Right. Instead, you have her pick up a baby. And there's clearly an upside down cross hanging above it as a, I don't know, a little mobile or whatever, mobile. And she says, you know, after all, it's half me or whatever, or at least that's implied.
Right.
So that would be.
So now we never see the baby. We never see the baby.
We don't.
Right. Okay.
No, we do see the eyes of.
Okay. That's.
I can't remember.
But we see he has his father's eyes.
She says he has his father's eyes, and we see the eyes in the rape scene, and they're vertical slits for pupils.
But we don't see them in the baby.
I don't think
so. And we're not seeing like the It's Alive sort of baby. We never see that.
No.
That's what I thought. That's what I remember.
I'm not even sure if you see that baby in It's Alive, do you? I know you see it in the sequels, but I can't. It's been so long since I've seen that movie.
I don't think so. If you do, I think you just see like the claws.
Yeah.
Or something, you know. The claw.
What a segue. One thing I did want to bring up is this was also a bid for respectability for our favorite Schlockmeister, William Castle, who was known for gimmicks. You know, doing the tingler and electrifying seats in theaters and, you know, handing out barf bags for horror movies or I can't remember what he did for The Haunting of Hill House. Anyway, he had always been a schlocky director, but he produced this film. It was kind of cool to see his name up there on the screen with what you would call a legitimate motion picture. So it was not only Polanski's bid for stardom. It was Mia Farrow's and William Castle, at least a bid for respectability. Did you know that the original cut, you're going to love this, ran over 4 hours?
How? What would possibly be?
Well, there is a scene. I don't know a lot of it. And obviously, he let Sam Osteen decide. I guess that's the editor. But one of the scenes that was cut was some random scene of Van Johnson and Joan Crawford coming out of a movie, and they just kind of went up to them and let them play themselves. I guess they just ran. Because, you know, a lot of people are in that area of New York where they film. The Dakota building where they filmed, a lot of people lived in that building. It's where John Lennon lived. He was shot in front of it. Boris Karloff lived in that building. Lauren Bacall lived in that building. A lot of famous people were around that neighborhood. And I think Roman just took advantage of it. And he was guerrilla filmmaking on the street. You saw that scene where she's crossing traffic. That's him with the camera. He basically said, look, you're pregnant. No one's going to hit you. Just go out there and I'll film it. And no other cameraman would do it. He had to do it. because they're in New York traffic, you know.
Right.
So, I mean, I you got to admire him for things like that, except for maybe endangering Mia Farrow's life. I'm sure Frank Sinatra served her divorce papers on the set, so it wouldn't have been like he cared. But anyway.
Ah.
That's a little bit of trivia for you as well.
There you go. Yeah.
Any other thoughts or scenes that came out or stick out with you before we move on to casting?
Scenes. Well, overall, let me just glance at the notes and see if I have anything, but I know scenes. I think I loved the scene meeting the girl in the laundry room basement and the fact that the building is scary and kind of creepy. But then I think her death was very gratuitous and really I didn't see it advancing anything other than, oh, well, that was unexpected, sort of thing. Of course, I love the ending. I like the whole dream nightmare rape sequence is great. I love the whole pacing of her getting out. You know, of her finally going to the other doctor, and I'm going to get away.
That
and
fucking
I now
Charles
suspect
Grodin,
my husband.
Asshole.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not the Charles Grodin, yeah. Such a funny guy. Look at him.
He's a dick.
But I thought that was good. Of course, I like all the scenes with Ruth Gordon. She's great, and that character, it works so well. Mia Farrow works so well.
You know what scene sticks out the most to me with Ruth Gordon? It's the one where they're over at Minnie and Roman's house having dinner, and she is serving them with the fork she's eating with. She's like just eating and putting stuff on their plates and stuff. I'm like, she's like an animal. It's crazy.
Dripping on the carpet. Why are you dripping on the carpet? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. The theme song is another plus for me for
this.
Did you
know that that was actually Mia Farrow that sang that?
I did see that and thought, okay, that works for me. That works. Although I do have to say, and this did not happen, 30 plus years ago when I saw the movie originally, but there were so many scenes in this where she looked like Gwyneth Paltrow. To me, a lot in just a lot of her expressions. Her facial structure is very similar, and parts of it were it really pulled me out and bugged me because I was
Dennis watched part of it with me. We thought the same only with Michelle Williams because Michelle Williams actually had that haircut too.
Okay, I can see
you
that.
You know what I mean?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
But yeah, I could see Gwyneth too, for sure.
Yeah, a lot. Yeah. But that's basically it. I mean, I've got some more structural stuff as far as just just some details that jumped out to me, like trivia stuff when I was watching it.
Okay.
But we can get to that.
Okay. Well, let's start with Rosemary herself. Rosemary Woodhouse was played by Mia Farrow. Mia has had a little bit of a history with troubled directors, I would say.
Good way of putting
this it. This is the movie that put her on the map. And, of course, Roman Polanski lives in Europe now because of a statutory rape case in about 1969 or 70, wasn't it? When was it?
Mm-hmm.
It was sometime, 70. I guess, after Chinatown. Anyway, yep. So... Roman has a shady
reputation. Little bit of a quaalude. Oh my gosh. It's the '70s. Come on.
And then she was also partnered with Woody Allen, and he ended up having an affair with one of their adopted children to whom he is still with, Soon Yi Allen. I don't know what her last name is. So Mia Farrow has had her a share of bad dudes other than Guy Woodhouse, her husband in this movie.
Yeah.
I will say that Patty Duke auditioned for this role. I think she would have been a good choice as well. Just because
probably
she had
at the
that,
time, especially.
Yeah, she had that innocence to her, and she was probably trying to break out of that. I thought that was kind of cool. He originally wanted Tuesday Weld. She passed.
I don't think she would have the chops to do it. But she would have looked pretty, but I don't think she would have...
Yeah, I mean, she didn't go on to do anything else that memorable that I recall.
No.
So
no.
Jane Fonda was approached, which I found very interesting, but she turned it down for Barbarella, which we were just talking about.
Yes, we were.
And then Sharon Tate obviously was considered, but Roman felt that was unethical because they were dating at the time.
She would have been good.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah. I think she would have gone on to be a good actress had she not been murdered by Charles Manson.
Oh yeah,
which
totally agree.
And a lot of that stuff that happened in '69, right? So that stuff that happened shortly after this movie came out.
Oh yeah,
yeah. That's mm-hmm. there's a lot of that. That's another reason why this movie is probably iconic. It's because of the period of time it came out. Because it was a big horror movie in a time where a lot of shit went down in the late 60s.
Yeah, I could see that.
Right after the Summer of Love. So, others considered were Julie Christie, Elizabeth Hartman, and Joanna Pettit. The last two are British. I know them vaguely. The last three. Julie Christie's British too, isn't she?
Yeah.
So all three of them are British. So they would have been a little bit more unknown, perhaps, to American audiences. But I have to say, I'm quite satisfied with Mia Farrow's performance in this movie. I think she's great.
I do too. Yeah. I think she's great in this movie.
All right. The one that we weren't...
You know, and I just did a cursory look real quick before you jump to the next one is... Because you were talking about at this time, and it seemed like at this time, 68 through 70, 71, in that area, horror movies didn't know where they were going. They didn't have any monsters and iconic monsters they could play with anymore.
Night of the Living
Hammer
Dead.
Hammer was trying.
Night of the Living Dead was
68. Yeah, but...
Yeah.
So you had the birth of that, which was the zombie, and then everything seemed to be going more toward satanic horror.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
a lot in the 70s, especially.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm just looking at titles and ghost stories, you know, Haunted House of Horror, The Oblong Box, Satan Sadist, Scream Baby Scream, Fear No Evil. So a lot of it was going toward this kind
of... I remember that Fear No Evil movie. I think it was Canadian. It was a good one.
Yeah, but toward that existential horror coming at us sort of thing, mm-hmm. you know, rather than... The there's a monster, there's a Frankenstein.
Right. Expanding the tropes, so to speak. Guy Woodhouse, who we're not that crazy. I mean, I thought John Cassavetes was good too. He's more known for being a director. As a matter of fact, he's like the godfather of independent filmmaking. He's the one that put small films on the map. But he did star in a few. He was in this. He was in The Dirty Dozen.
Yeah.
He was married to Gina Rowlands, directed her in an indie movie, and she won an Oscar for it. He directed some other lady in a movie, and she won an Oscar, too. So, I mean, he's got a pretty good pedigree as far as direction.
He came from theater, too, which is what makes him, I think, a really good actor. He came from theater and did a lot of theater for television.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of the Kraft Playhouse and, you know, a lot of those back then in the late 50s when they were doing a lot of theater on television
mm-hmm.
sort of thing.
And his son, Nick, is a director too, right?
Nick Cassavetes,
Jack Nicholson was suggested for this role, but guess why he didn't get it?
Little Shop of Horrors.
No. He was deemed too sinister. Which is what...
And Cassavetes wasn't?
Think about it. That's what Stephen King has always said about him in The Shining, is that you know he's going to be bad from the very beginning. So...
Yep.
I thought that was interesting. But he did, I guess, become friends with Roman and went on to do Chinatown, which was huge and also was... It was at Jack Nicholson's house where that whole incident happened that got Roman... to Europe and never back in the States again with the young lady.
A little hot tub. Jeez, come on.
Robert Evans was a producer on this movie. He's he's a relatively famous producer. And he wanted Robert Redford. And I thought, you know what?
That would have been good casting.
And the negotiations apparently broke down because Paramount's lawyers served the actor with a subpoena over a contractual dispute regarding his pulling out of some movie I've never heard called Blue. So that kind of nicks Redford being in this film. It was an issue with Paramount and lawyers. Also considered Richard Chamberlain, who at times I've thought was Satan himself. He actually played a priest in The Thornbirds. My mother just
The Thornbirds. Oh, my God. Ugh. Yes.
Anyway, Richard Chamberlain did not get it. Also considered were two actors I don't know, James Fox and Lawrence Harvey. Actually, they weren't considered. They begged to do it. That's why I haven't heard of them, because they couldn't get a job. And then Warren Beatty turned it down. I'm not sure about that.
He would have been good too. I could see that. I could see him. I think the idea of somebody, Redford would have been perfect because everybody trusted him, liked him. He's handsome. He's nice. Da da da. And then turns out to be the bad guy.
Right.
You know, it's like what was the Harrison Ford one?
Frantic.
With
I just thought of it.
No,
no, but that's the Roman.
The Roman Polanski one. Yes. There's another Harrison Ford, like, See No Evil or Evil Below Us, Below the Surface, Down Below, something.
The one with Michelle Pfeiffer. What Lies Beneath.
What Lies Beneath. And he's, the, you know, he's Harrison Ford until, like, near the end you realize, oh, my God, he's the bad guy. Mm-hmm. You know, and that was the effect we could have gotten.
With Redford.
Had we not. Yeah, with Redford.
Or Beatty, maybe. Yeah. Another person tested, this will not surprise you at all. He went on to fame and fortune 4 years later, but it was probably a little too early, and that was Burt Reynolds.
Burt, yeah.
He was doing a lot of TV in the 60s. He did, you know, Alfred Hitchcock, Twilight Zone, Westerns, like maybe Cheyenne. I can't remember what it was, but I've seen him in Westerns too. As far as casting, that's pretty much it as far as alternatives. I will go through the cast really quickly, though. We talked about Minnie Castevette being played by Ruth Gordon, who is fabulous.
Fabulous.
Roman Castevette was played by Sidney Blackmer.
He was really good, too.
I thought so, too. There was a suggestion. I did not write it down because none of us are going to know them. But apparently, I think it was Castevette. You said he was in the theater world. There was an there was an old vaudevillian couple that he wanted to get cast in this, but nobody knew who they were, including me. So I'm quite glad they got Ruth Gordon instead.
Yes,
Hutch is another great cast member. Maurice Evans, whom I love. Yes. Maurice was known for playing Samantha Evans' father on Bewitched, and Dr. Zaius.
Well, Dr. Zaius! He's Dr. Zaius.
On Planet of the Apes.
What will you find?
Yes. So we have, yes. And he's a good guy in this one, which is nice.
His destiny. Yeah.
Dr. Saperstein is played by Ralph Bellamy. There's another key for you right there. He went on to be in Ghost Story, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep,
with Melvin Douglas, who I mentioned earlier in The Old Dark House. They were both in Ghost Story with Fred Astaire. Wow, that's a lot of freaking casting keys.
There you go.
Terry was played by Victoria Vetri, and I read not many other roles for her. She didn't do a lot. Laura Louise was Patsy Kelly, and then and we mentioned Charles Grodin was Dr. Hill,
evil Dr. Hill. Yes, it was Grodin.
But
yes.
The one other I want to mention, because it's a slight key to our Patreon podcast on Star Trek, is Mr. Nicholas was played by Elisha Cook Jr.
From Star Trek's
Court Martial, which we talked about.
And from, the one with Red Jack. He's in that too.
Oh, another Star Trek? Well, that's okay, because he's also in Messiah of Evil, and he played Weasel in the original Salem's Lot miniseries. So, there you go.
Well, there you go.
Elisha Cook Jr., very recognizable character actor, played Mr. Nicholas, one of the Satanists.
Yes. Oh, no, I'm getting him confused with, because Elijah Cook was, yeah, he was one of the worshipers kind of thing. But the guy, the realtor. No,
Elijah Cook was the defender, wasn't he? Wasn't he the lawyer?
Yeah, yeah, but I mean, he was one of the Satanists in Rosemary.
Right. He was one of the neighbors. The
one that I'm talking about was the realtor that showed him the apartment at the very beginning was Red Jack from Wolf in the Fold. The episode where Jack the Ripper has lived through the galaxy,
Robert Block,
kind of thing.
We were just talking about earlier.
Yes, so there's some keys references it's there. Look at that noise.
Christmas paradox we're finding ourselves in here today. Or should I say late November paradox? I mentioned that Ruth Gordon is serving with the fork she's eating with. Another thing that stuck out to me as far as scenes that I love is the music. With the labor scene, when she's going into labor, it's this really erratic jazz music that sounds like Miles Davis, like blasting trumpets and stuff. I thought that was very unique.
Yeah,
that really stuck out with me. That's all I have for casting. I can go to awards, or we can go back to
do that, and then we'll do keys. Okay. Yeah.
This movie was an Oscar. Excuse me. Sorry. Got segued there because it was something I just remembered I wanted to say about the Oscars. It was an Oscar winner for supporting actress, Ruth Gordon. It was nominated for screenplay. It won a Golden Globe for supporting actress, yet again, Ruth Gordon. And it was a nominee for actress with Mia Farrow, screenplay, and score. So it was nominated for 4 Golden Globes, won 1, 2 Oscars, won 1. Mia was also nominated for a BAFTA. So what I was going to get to is, I did not realize this. You may remember this, and I'm going to read it because I don't want to misquote it. Despite winning the David D. Donatello Award for Best Foreign Actress and the Fotogramas de Plata Award for Best Foreign Movie Performer, and also being nominated for Best Actress at the Laurel Awards, the Golden Globes, and the BAFTAs, Mia Farrow was not nominated for an Oscar for her performance. And today, this is considered one of the most notorious Oscar snubs. Did you know that?
I did not know that. No.
I didn't either. I found it fascinating, though, because she was nominated for those others and won one of them. So,
and she should have been nominated for this. Yeah. I wonder who won that year.
Huh. Was that maybe Bonnie and Clyde?
Oh, God, no, please. Really?
I don't know. I'm just thinking 68. I don't know. It was Barbara from Night of the Living Dead.
No.
Johnny has the keys. Okay, so I will also let you know that it is in the book. What book is that, David?
The 1001.
Yes, the 1001 movies you must see before you die. Satan has made the list.
Oh, the winner was Katharine Hepburn for Guess Who's Coming to Dinner.
Oh, I figured it was African Queen. Okay.
That's who won that year. But she beat out Faye Dunaway and Bonnie and Clyde.
Oh.
So there you go.
Hey. Hey.
You were good there. Gotta admit, that's good. Mm-hmm. That's some good stuff.
And I was only 3.
So I had a horror question based on my notes. Right. Was this the first, oh my God, I've been raped by the devil movie?
Was there a rape scene in Curse of the Demon?
I think it might have been.
I can't remember.
No way. How could it be? No, there wasn't a rape scene.
Not that I'm aware of. I don't think so. But it was the first of several satanic children movies, and I'll get to that in just a second. Actually, here it is right here. This movie begins a tradition of horrific pregnancy scenes, including Alien, The Brood, The Fly, Prometheus, It's Alive, and it The Quiet Place, or A Quiet Place. Is that what that movie is? Yeah, Quiet Place.
And half of those we have done on this podcast.
A lot of them we have. and that was actually about pregnancy, not satanic babies. There was a lot of satanic right. children after that, too, as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yes.
Because we had all definitely. The Omen movies and things like that. Mm-hmm. Did you have any other, I don't know, trivia or keys? Or do you want to go into keys? I have several, actually.
Yeah, we can do keys.
Okay.
I mean, I had, of course, some of the ones that I guess they're keys. They're not really references, not really keys, but they're references. So, like, her dream on the yacht was like she was Jacqueline Onassis, or she was with the Kennedys or something. It was just a really weird dream, and I was going, is this supposed to be, like, sort of funny or sort of not, or what are they making fun of? You know, it was very unique in that. I thought that was a weird reference.
Well, you brought up something earlier. You said that you thought Roman Polanski was known for isolating characters. Yes. I think Roman being someone to always bring comedy to something. I always find funny things in his movies.
Agreed.
In this one, it's Rick Gordon, has a good, obviously.
But he uses his comedy as realistic comedy. Mm-hmm. It either comes to the character or it comes from a situation that is comedy, but it's not like wit and parry repartee kind of comedy. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's realistic to me in the way he portrays
it. Right. Well, and that whole yacht scene dream thing kind of struck me as funny too, or definitely odd.
Yeah. And like the other one, there's definitely a key in the first sequence because, you know, it pans up from her starting to dream, and suddenly we see the Sistine Chapel and everything. Mm-hmm. You know, so now we know there's going to be some kind of religious allegory that happens, which I thought was interesting. Mm-hmm. I have a key in that right after the rape scene, they talk about going to see a play, and they went and saw The Fantastics.
That's it. That's the scene where they run into Joan Crawford and Van Johnson. It's out in front of the marquee, and it says The Fantastics.
Okay. Well, I thought it was interesting because, you know, the big controversy about The Fantastics is the big song about rape.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that was kind of an interesting, you know, if I had not, you know, done and seen The Fantastics, I would not have, you know, connected
I've not done it, but together. I saw your production of it. I do remember it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that was one of my keys. You go ahead and do some, and then I'll have some more.
Sorry, I got lost in my trivia. I mentioned that the La 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 song was sung by Mia Farrow.
Mia.
But it reminded me of that weird children singing stuff we later see in Argento's Deep Red. 1975.
Oh, yeah. I could see that.
Which would have been 7 years later. So.
Okay.
Also, Rosemary's name is a reference to Mary, mother of Jesus.
Rosemary. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
So.
I have one that maybe you can help me with. She, when she's drinking the milkshake and she's losing weight and she's freaking out, she's got that great makeup with the hollow, sunken, she's losing weight kind of thing.
Yeah, she looks rough, man.
Yeah, I love the makeup because it looks realistic, too. It's a really good job. She, at one point, eats a raw steak.
Yeah.
And as soon as she did it, I thought, okay, there was a TV movie with Elizabeth McGovern having a demon baby.
Are you talking about Elizabeth or Montgomery? Or an
alien. Elizabeth Montgomery having a demon baby or an alien baby or something, and she eats raw steak.
I don't remember that.
In the TV movie.
I remember her playing Lizzie Gordon, though.
Yeah, but this was, I think, before that. But she played a woman who had been impregnated, and I think it was alien because this was in the 70s. So I think it was an alien, but she was eating raw steak. And as soon as I saw that, I was going, okay, that's a key reference I have to ask Tim about. So, yeah.
There's a, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say there's a huge literary key with this and Nathaniel Hawthorne's Young Goodman Brown. Are you familiar with that story?
I've heard the title, but not really.
It's one of those that sometimes you'll read it in high school, but if you're an English major, you're definitely going to read it in college. It's like an American literary classic. And it involves, you know, Nathaniel Hawthorne was from Salem, Massachusetts. So a lot of his stuff was influenced by what was going on or what went on there with
witches.
Yes. And Young Goodman Brown sees a community differently through like a funhouse mirror where you see them as their good selves and you see them as their bad selves. Very similar to this with the neighbors in the apartment building. And there's also a big orgy in both that plays prominent. There's just lots of parallels. So if anyone out there, I'm a huge Nathaniel Hawthorne fan. He wrote some really cool, scary short stories. I highly recommend it. So go read Young Goodman Brown and you'll see what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another one.
I've got Tanis Root. I'm sorry. As soon as they said Tanis, I'm thinking mummy. I'm thinking, you know, rituals. I'm thinking,
and you know there is no such thing, right?
Yeah, but it's made up. So associated. It's so associated with the whole mummy myth, you know, that immediately made me suspect.
I didn't even think.
But I like, Hutch in every scene he's in. I think Maurice Evans is really good. I think his chemistry with her is awesome. Mm-hmm. And I like, whether it's Roman or Ira, because I've never read the novel, so I can't say. But the way they do the puzzle all the way through it of losing a personal article, the necklace, the anagram, the, you know, all of that puzzle work all the way through, I thought was really good.
It's got like a little voodoo twist to it as well. Like a witchcraft voodoo kind of thing. Yeah.
Yep.
I have another literary clue. Surprise, surprise. Sure. Arthur Machen wrote a story. It's actually a classic story called The Great God Pan. Very similar story where the character is impregnated by Pan. And in this one, the character is impregnated by Satan. So a little parallel going on there as well with that classic. I believe that was 1890. Nathaniel Hawthorne may have been a little bit. I can't remember when that story of Nathaniel Hawthorne's came out. Anyway, they're both old. I told you about the conspiracy stuff with Ira Levin. I've already mentioned that. Mia Farrow went on to play a nanny to Devil Child in the remake of The Omen in 2006.
Okay.
I guess she needed some work. That movie was released on June 6th of 2006, 666. And in this movie, the baby is to be born in June of 66. Isn't it set in 66? Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
So there's three sixes there, too. So you see the 666 start playing a lot after this movie in movies like The Omen as well. So that would be a key, just the number itself.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
For sure.
Definitely.
Ira wrote a novel called Son of Rosemary in 1997. I guess he needed some money too. So I only have one other clue that I don't want to go into too deeply because you have not seen it. And I strongly feel we will probably cover this next season because it is such a renowned movie. The movie Hereditary by Ari Aster has keys out the wazoo in it. And there are some big ones from Rosemary's Baby in it as well. So,
cool. I do want to see it. And that would be a good one for us to definitely add to the list. I agree. I wanted to say, as far as a horror movie goes, the last sequence in this works really well. From the elevator chase up through the hearing the chanting, up through the seeing the baby, you know, little things that he does are really good. Like all this frenetic music with the elevator and everything. And then suddenly when she does the big confrontation with all of them, there is no music at all at the end of this movie. And I thought that was really
It's disturbing. Cool. Yeah.
I thought spitting in his face was great. I thought her with the knife reaching out and stopping the crib from moving with the knife, I thought was really just a great touch. Mm-hmm.
It's like something you do on stage.
Yeah. And then, of course, the stuff of what have you done to his eyes? He has his father's eyes. Then everybody's doing Hail Satan, Hail Satan. And da-da-da. I was just going, oh, see, now that I think was the maybe for 68 audiences was
exactly
was terrifying.
Exactly.
You know, the fact that our old wealthy neighbors are actually Satanists. You know?
Well, and I'm not sure, but there was a big...
Republicans are Satanists? What?
No. Republicans in the Dakota building? I don't think so.
Never. Not going to happen.
The, I don't know what the... I don't know the exact time period, but there was a period in the late 60s, early 70s where satanic cults were like a huge fear. I'm sure it started with rumors. It could have started with a murder that I'm unaware of. Even the Manson murders played into it. So having that at the end of this movie, I mean, maybe it was this movie that started all that. I don't know.
Might have.
But something resonated with people in the end of this movie, because this movie was huge and people freaked out, just like The Exorcist. People freaked out with The Exorcist too.
Well, I don't think The Exorcist would have had as much clout or gotten as much without this movie. I think that's a good key, mm-hmm. actually, too. Mm-hmm. I think this movie probably may have started that surge of fear of the cults, you know, fear that the nice, sweet people next door are really evil, you know, Satan worshipers.
Right. And I've got some other movies that are devil-related this season. And one of them is actually the very same year, 1968.
Yeah. Well, we've had, you know, we've had some interesting crossover this season. It might be neat to do a recap at the end of the season and just how all of these keys related to each other.
Oh, wow. Kind of like a key episode, you know? Based on just the schedule. Yeah, that's kind of interesting.
A big key ring kind of thing, because they all relate, you know, so much.
Right.
Yeah. We've done two Polanskis. We've done, you know, blah, blah, blah. This many baby movies, whatever. Yeah.
I had one other thing I was going to say.
I want to stop coughing. There's a demon in my throat.
At the end of the novel, she considers killing him and committing suicide, but then, like Terry at the beginning of the novel, under similar... Oh, very much like Terry did in the movie at the beginning. She then takes pity on him, seeing the terrified look on the child's face. After considering all options, she decides to raise Andy as her own, even though he's a demon. She decides to love him and mother him and let her good-natured human personality influence him, hoping to do good. He's half devil and half me. She also decides to report everything to the Pope and the Vatican and to let them handle the issue as they see fit. So,
sure.
Yeah, whatever. That's not what I wanted to tell you. This is what I found very funny, though. This is Mia Farrow. I'm going to read this. Mia Farrow said in a recent interview that the actor playing the devil, Clay Tanner, was completely naked during the rape scene, dressed up in demonic makeup with vertical contact lenses. She said Tanner spent hours grinding on top of her as they were shooting the rape scene. After they were done, he got up, shook Mia's hand, and in a very cordial and businessman-type way said, "Miss Farrow, it was a pleasure working with you." Mia shook his hand back and said, "Thank you. He was a very lovely man," she said.
Sure.
The devil was on top of me, raping me, but he was a very lovely man.
Yeah. Hey, Bob, we got a pot for you. I need you to grind on Mia Farrow.
Isn't that great, though? I mean, that just shows you the behind the scenes of what happens. You know, we know this movie for what it is. This is the kind of thing Mia Farrow remembers. I just think that's hilarious.
Right.
Yeah.
That's great.
So, any final thoughts on this devil baby?
I think it deserves its iconic place as one of the great horror movies of definitely of Devil Babies, but just of the late 60s, early 70s.
It's a landmark.
I think it.
For sure.
Yeah. It is.
And wasn't 2001 68, too?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
That was a sci-fi landmark, too.
Talk about, you know, opposite polar ends of the world. Yeah. Even though that one has a baby at the end of it, too.
Right.
Ooh, Star Baby. So, yeah. Well, cool. All of you out there listening and or watching, we want to say thank you, of course, as
for
always.
For joining us in our Devil Christmas.
Devil Christmas.
Actually,
yes.
It's not over. And we have two more before Christmas.
We have two more Christmas presents for you before the holidays, and we just want to say thank you, guys. We would ask that you give us a good review, or give us a star, or give us a thumbs up.
Subscribe on YouTube.
Like. Please subscribe on YouTube. If you want to consider being a Patreon member, we would love to have you. Patreon members get some extra special perks. So we hope you would join that. And Tim, for you, I guess I'll see you next time when we go in a little bit more science fiction-y.
I think so. Yeah. And I want to tell you, I have enjoyed your fireplace and your Christmas tree. It's been quite warm and cozy in here.
Lovely. So... But we'll see you all next time.
You have a good one.